You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, a new package of bills in the state capitol aims to prevent housing discrimination and reduce wrongful evictions. A state lawmaker will join us to share the details. First, you might think that the bears in your community are getting ready to hibernate right about now. The weather's getting colder, the days are getting shorter, but bears don't actually hibernate, it turns out. They enter periods of dormancy, but they wake up real easy. Gemma Tarlak is here to educate us about bears and other cool science news. She's a senior editor at Discover Magazine based in Waukesha. Gemma, good to talk to you again.
Hello, and happy science to you.
And you too. Well, before we get to those bears, Gemma, we'll tease that for now. Let's start with an even bigger living organism. I guess it's the biggest on the planet, and I never heard of it. Pando.
Yeah.
What is Pando?
Well, you know, if you say the largest known living organism on Earth, I think most people would think the blue whale, for example. But this thing is way bigger than a blue whale. It is 106 acres big. It's an aspen stand in southern Utah named Pando. And it looks, to you or me, just walking through it, like a whole forest of beautiful aspen trees. But it's actually a single root system that may be, we're not sure how old it is, but it may be as old as 13,000 years. And basically, it just kept cloning itself, one sprout after the next. So this enormous 106-acre stand of aspen is a single living organism.
That's kind of mind-blowing, Gemma.
I know. And sadly, though, Pando's not doing so well.
Right. Why researchers are worried about the health of this huge, long-lived aspen organism? What's going on?
Yeah, the whole generational system is out of whack. It's basically, Pando is basically an old folks home right now. There is just not enough new shoots and new aspen in it, and it's because there are too many herbivores. There are too many mule deer, too many elk in particular that love nibbling on Pando, and there are too many of them. There are too few of the herbivores' natural predators, such as wolves and cougars. And because of that, the whole balance is out of whack, and they're just chomping away at Pando.
So a new shoot comes up, and the deer and other herbivores eat it before it gets big enough to establish.
Exactly, exactly.
So are there thoughts on what could be done to save this unique, weird thing?
Yeah, you know, in fact, since 2013, a large portion of Pando has been fenced off, and they're looking at growth inside the fence and also outside the fence that's still unprotected from herbivores. And the stuff inside the fence is doing so much better. It's regenerating. New shoots are growing and maturing. It's incredible how it's something like more than three times the number of new shoots are inside that fenced area.
Well, that'll be an interesting story to keep tabs on. I want to go a little further away now, Gemma. A tale of two dwarf planets. We've got Pluto, no longer a full-on planet, a dwarf planet now, way out there.
And you sound like you're bitter.
No, I'm okay with that. I was okay either way on that one. And here's an argument we were having, what I would call Ceres, a dwarf planet in the asteroid belt. Apparently, it's technically Ceres, the pronunciation. I don't know if I buy that. But anyway, Ceres, another dwarf planet. It's between Mars and Jupiter with the asteroids. And they have something in common apart from their size. What's going on?
Yeah. You know, I'm going to say Ceres. But as we talk, I might change my mind and go to Ceres. So,
I haven't committed.
But, you know, you hear all the time in medicine about these twin studies where two fraternal twins grow up in different environments and develop very differently despite being born at the same time in the same place and sharing so many genes. And astronomers think increasingly that is what's happening with Ceres and Pluto. They think they are actually fraternal twins, that they came into being in the same area of our solar system at about the same time, and then the bigger planets like Jupiter kind of pushed them around, and Ceres moved in closer toward the sun in that nasty asteroid belt, and Pluto, poor Pluto, got pushed way out into the icy wastes of the distant solar system. So it's really interesting because we never thought they were that much alike. And if you look at them superficially, it looks like, oh, they're just two completely different kinds of dwarf planets. But astronomers think more and more they're fraternal twins that just grew up in different neighborhoods.
So do we know where they came from originally? What formed both of them?
Well, there are a couple different theories. And, you know, the beginning of our solar system was just a super chaotic time. There were bits of rock, basically, that would eventually form planets and kind of crunch up together and form a planet. There were asteroids smacking into everything, and there were these other enormous planets, again, like Jupiter. I pick on Jupiter because, you know, it's kind of easy to. But Jupiter just kind of shoving everything around. And they're not really sure yet, because we're not exactly sure that they're fraternal twins, but the signs are increasing that they kind of both formed sort of in the middle of, if you want to think of the radius of our solar system with the sun at the middle and then heading further out, they kind of formed in the middle of the range of our solar system. And then Ceres got pushed in and Pluto got shoved out.
And we didn't used to know much about Pluto, but we had this great flyby that gave us a lot of data. Are we going to be able to do a lot of compare and contrast Ceres, Pluto, and learn a lot more about our solar system?
You know, it was in 2015 that not only did New Horizons fly past Pluto, I think we all remember those incredible images that we saw, but also there's another mission called Dawn that began orbiting Ceres. So basically, we're just now getting this data, and astronomers are just now analyzing it, and it's really the whole fraternal twins idea has really gained speed after looking at the data since 2015. And as more data comes in, I think we're going to have more answers.
Gemma Tarlak is with us from Discover Magazine. We're looking at some of the coolest stories in the world of science. And Gemma, you've had bears on your mind lately and wrote a piece about them. What sparked this piece on bears?
The bears. Well, you know, I love bears, and I think they're really fascinating. I think a lot of times they seem to be one of those animals that just a lot of people think they know a lot about bears, like the whole hibernating thing, right? Bears don't hibernate, as you mentioned. They enter a period of dormancy. It's not a pure, true hibernation. And also, there's no bear on the planet that gets most of its food from honey. They actually, there are a couple different kinds of bears called honey bears, colloquially, but they actually eat the insects more than the honey. So, you know, the whole Winnie the Pooh, total fabrication. Sorry, folks, it's just not true. Bears eat stuff other than honey. And one of the things I find really interesting about bears is, you know, we've heard about polar bears and how they're being affected by climate change, but it's not just polar bears. For example, on Alaska's Kodiak Island, the entire food web, which bears are a huge part of, is being shifted due to climate change.
I think the important question on people's minds is, with a backup quarterback, do the Packers have a chance against the Bears tonight? Oh, wrong Bears. I'm sorry, Gemma. Wrong Bears, wrong magazine, actually. No, but seriously,
that's okay.
You mentioned the hibernation thing earlier, and I don't want to just brush past that, because if there's one fact of nature that we all know, it's that bears hibernate, and you're telling me bears don't hibernate.
No, they are not true hibernators. And when you look at a true hibernator, like, say, a ground squirrel, it lowers its metabolic rate by more than 90% in winter months. Bears do not do that. They might lower their metabolic rate by up to 50%, and they lower their heart rate and their body temperature, but they're typically awake about 15 minutes a day during the winter period. And even when they're not actually awake, they are very easily roused. So, you know, not the ground squirrel. The ground squirrel is kind of out for the count until it wakes up in spring, but bears are easily roused. And it's also really interesting, if you look at a bear in dormancy versus, say, a human on bed rest for the same amount of time, bears in dormancy don't experience severe muscle atrophy or any of the other conditions we might see arise in if you or I were on bed rest for 6 months. And that's because their bodies have evolved these really unique, fascinating adaptations to, for example, reabsorb waste product and recycle it into protein to preserve their lean body mass. You know, bears have it figured out. Evolution has really figured it out for them, and they don't need to hibernate. So why hibernate?
That's pretty impressive, actually, and as tempting as it might be to only get up out of bed in the winter for 15 minutes a day, we have not evolved to do that.
No. Do not try this at home, folks. Get up and keep moving around. Otherwise, you will be very sorry when the days start getting longer.
You write about the size of bears. Bears, big animals, but tell us about the largest bear ever.
Oh, my gosh. Okay. If you can imagine a polar bear, double it. And that is Arctotherium angustidens. This was a short-faced bear. It was huge, you know, kind of on its hind legs standing up. It would have been twice as tall as the average human. And as I said, twice the mass of a polar bear. And it lived in South America a couple million years ago. Sadly, it went the way of other megafauna and is no longer with us. But it's a pretty impressive animal to think about.
And before we wrap up, Gemma, what do you wish you knew about bears that you don't, even after all this research?
There's always more to learn, always.
Gemma, thanks a lot for joining us today. I appreciate it.
Thanks. Have a good one.
That's Gemma Tarlak, senior editor at Discover Magazine. She's based in Waukesha. She joins us about once a month to share some of the coolest science news. First, having an eviction as part of your housing history makes it much harder to rent a new home. And for people dealing with job loss or low income, being evicted can lead to a level of poverty that's tough to get out of. A new package of bills in the state capitol aims to give low-income residents dealing with housing instability more options to avoid evictions and make their rent payments. The Housing Eviction and Discrimination Prevention Package would establish rent credits, clarify laws on discrimination and rent abatement, and create a legal defense fund for low-income tenants facing eviction. Representative Jimmy Anderson represents the state's 47th Assembly District, which includes Fitchburg. He's a co-sponsor of this package. Representative Anderson, thanks for joining us on Central Time.
Oh, no, thank you so much for having me.
Before we get into the details of this legislation, what are the current conditions out there in Wisconsin in housing that inspired you to join in on this package of bills?
Yeah, I would say that I had read the book Evicted, and it was just so incredibly powerful and moving, and being able to really understand what's happening throughout Wisconsin when it comes to eviction and people losing their homes really encouraged me to want to try to make a difference in this on this issue.
And that book, Evicted, by Matthew Desmond, what happens to someone once they've hit that cycle where they're being evicted? How does that haunt them, not just on eviction day, but after?
Yeah, it's like it could honestly just be a spiral down into what is ultimately homelessness, and it makes it incredibly hard for people to put their lives back together. I mean, when you hear these stories of people who are, you know, just working two jobs and they're trying to raise their kids and trying to make ends meet, and you know, one little thing goes wrong and then it just spirals down from there. And so we want to make sure that we provide legislation that would make sure that they would have the support that they need, so that way people who are on the edge aren't being pushed off and forgotten.
And let's get into some of the specifics. There's a number of different bills in this package. There's one, the Rental Credit Assistance Act. It would create a program in, I think, four counties to help people make their rent. How would it work?
So essentially, I would say that Representative Crowley had been working with me on this issue, and that was definitely one of his focuses. But it would essentially what it would allow a renter to be able to do community participation or work within their own rental property, and then they would be able to get back credits that they would be able to put towards their rent.
So kind of a community service to help get rent credits, is that right?
That's correct. That's correct. Yep.
And so what kind of activities would that involve?
The details of which I don't think have been specifically worked out, but I imagine that work with most nonprofits would probably fall under this category.
And then another part of this package is the Renters Abatement Act. And reading up on this, it sounds like sometimes eviction is preceded by a landlord-tenant dispute. The tenant has concerns, mold or repairs needed in the apartment or household, and trying to withhold rent. People not clear on how to do that. Can you talk about what the Renters Abatement Act would do?
Right. So right now in the law, there's just not enough clarification as to what the duties are for the renter and what the duties are for the land, for the person who's doing the renting. And so basically the concerns are if the tenant misproperly withholds rent, they could be getting a lot of trouble for that. And then also there's no dollar amount that corresponds to how much should be held for and under what circumstances. So basically this just does a really good job of helping clarify the issue for everyone involved.
So does this lay out details of what you can withhold rent from and what kind of procedures you'd have to do?
Right, exactly. Yeah, but it would just make it a lot easier for everyone on both sides of the issue to understand what their responsibilities and duties are.
We're talking to Assembly Representative Jimmy Anderson from Fitchburg. He's a Democrat. He's a co-sponsor of a package of legislation aimed at preventing evictions here in Wisconsin and also housing discrimination. And let's get into that housing discrimination issue, Representative Anderson. One of the bills would prohibit discrimination based on arrest, conviction, or eviction records after a certain expiration period. Can you talk us through that?
Yeah, I mean, right now, so many individuals end up getting denied housing opportunities because of previous arrest or conviction records. And basically, I mean, we have to ask ourselves whether we're going to be living in a country that wants to just punish individuals or we actually want to be in the process of rehabilitation. And part of that and being able to get back on your feet is being able to rent property. And so we want to make sure that people who have gone through the system and have paid their debt to society have the ability to be able to rent property once they're out.
And it's a three-year period. So does that mean a prospective landlord couldn't consider a criminal record or housing history starting 3 years ago?
Yep, that's the legislation there.
Now, a landlord might be concerned, saying, you know, if there's something 4 or 5 years ago that you know, I'm not comfortable. There are other tenants in this location, or maybe the landlord even lives there. What would you say to a landlord who's concerned about that?
Well, I would say that if somebody's been out of prison for 5 years and they've had a clean record, that they really should, again, focus on the idea of rehabilitation. This person obviously wants to become a part of society and wants to be able to contribute again, and they should be excited about that opportunity to be able to provide a home for someone trying to make ends meet.
And then, Representative Anderson, one more piece of legislation. This would establish a legal defense fund for low-income people facing eviction. Can you talk about what that fund would look like and how it might help prevent evictions?
Yeah, I mean, essentially, so many people end up going through the eviction process without legal representation. I'll just give you a quick example from my own life. My mother and father, my dad lost his job during the Great Recession, and they ended up being evicted from their home. I ended up losing my mom and dad in a car accident, but shortly after that, I got a letter in the mail basically saying that the process in which the bank went through to remove my parents from their home was illegal. And they didn't know that at the time. I mean, my dad was just a truck driver. My mother was a stay-at-home mom. They don't have that kind of legal expertise to know those kinds of things. And that happens a lot during the eviction process as well when it comes to people renting. And so we want to make sure that people have representations so that way they know all of their rights under the law.
How expensive would these bills be? There's some of them don't sound like they'd cost a lot, but there is funding that would be required for a couple of those items. How expensive would these be? Where would the money come from?
So, I mean, for a lot of these, like you said, it wouldn't necessarily cost very much. It would be more just a clarification of the law. And I think the most probably expensive one, I guess you would say, would be the one where the lawyers would have to provide representation. But if you look at other pilot programs that have been going on throughout the state, especially in places like New York, what you end up seeing is that being able to keep people in their homes is significantly cheaper than having to evict people and then have to provide homeless assistance or other kinds of public assistance that comes into play when people end up becoming homeless. So in the end, I mean, these bills end up saving more taxpayer money than they do spend.
Do you feel, as you talk about these issues, a sense of urgency in Wisconsin, especially after that book you mentioned, Evicted by Matthew Desmond, Evicted by Matthew Desmond, that this is a problem that we need to tackle here in Wisconsin?
I mean, I think we've seen it here, at least in Madison, when we see the homeless situation has kind of gotten a bit out of hand. And we've been trying to talk about the issue from the perspective of when somebody's already homeless. I think these bills do a really good job of preventing homelessness to begin with. And again, the book goes into great detail on what happened to four or five people that went through eviction processes in Milwaukee. And again, this is something that happens not just in our cities, but all throughout our state. And so we needed to be doing more to, again, not just try to help people when they become homeless, but to stop it from happening to begin with.
Is this a first step as you see it? Do you have ideas for more legislation helping the people who are, say, currently homeless?
Yeah, I mean, I know my representative, Lisa Subek, has introduced a lot of really great legislation that would address homelessness issues. I think that we as Democrats have been really trying to make this issue one of the more important pieces of legislation that we wanted to address throughout. You know, if we were ever to get an opportunity to be back in the majority, I think it'd be something we want to work on, passionately.
Now, with this package of legislation on eviction and housing discrimination, you are, as you say, not currently in the majority. Do you think there's a prospect to work with Republicans on at least some pieces of this package of legislation?
You always try to be hopeful, but as of now, we haven't received much support from our Republican colleagues. What's important about introducing bills like this is it allows people to take a look at it and make a determination for themselves whether or not this ought to be a focus for our government. I believe it should be because, you know, it's our duty to take care of one another. We're all, you know, one or two bad slip-ups away from being in a real dire circumstance when we would want these kinds of protections if we were put in that kind of position. So I do hope that looking forward that people would begin to support, politicians and representatives that try to look out for one another.
Representative Anderson, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Oh, thank you so much for having me.
That was State Representative Jimmy Anderson. He's a Democrat. He represents the state's 47th Assembly District, which includes Fitchburg. He joined us to talk about legislation he's co-sponsoring called the Housing Eviction and Discrimination Prevention Package. Do you have a story to tell? Is eviction part of your history, your family history? Are you a landlord? What's your perspective on these issues? You can email us at ideas@wpr.org. Let us know how all of this affects you. Now, Lake Superior is big. It's really big. It holds about 10% of the world's fresh water. And Lake Superior and its shoreline have been the site of economic booms and busts over the last 150 years. Shipping, timber, mining, tourism. The sheer size of Lake Superior can make it look too big to fail, too big for pollution to be a factor. But our next guest says the unique properties of Lake Superior make it vulnerable to pollution from within its watershed and beyond. And she says we can learn lessons from the future from successful conservation efforts of the past. Nancy Langston is a professor of environmental history at Michigan Technological University and a former professor at UW-Madison. Her new book is Sustaining Lake Superior, An Extraordinary Lake in a Changing World. Nancy, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you, Rob. It's great to be with you.
What is special? You live on the Keweenaw Peninsula. You get a lot of Lake Superior. What is it that is so special about Lake Superior?
Well, it's the largest freshwater lake in the world by surface area, which is pretty extraordinary. It's roughly the size of Maine. But even more than that, it's one of the wildest lakes on Earth. It's one of the coldest lakes on Earth. And it's one of the fastest changing lakes on Earth.
And as I said, it can look as you're standing on the shore like nothing is going to affect this thing. But you write it is in some ways uniquely vulnerable to different kinds of pollution. Why is that?
Well, because we're such a cold, cold watershed, and it's a cold lake with cold water in that remote northern place, it turns out that many pollutants that are produced in Asia and in the much more industrialized regions of the United States actually make their way from the places where they're produced and consumed up into the atmosphere, and they continue bouncing north like a grasshopper until they finally reach a really cold place. And when they come down into Lake Superior in snow or rain, they tend to get captured in the cold waters, and they accumulate more and more and more. So the very fact that we're so far north and so remote doesn't actually protect us as much against industrial pollution as everyone had assumed for generations.
And then when things make it to Lake Superior, you write that they stay there. It's got a long retention time. Stuff doesn't flow out of the lake quickly.
Exactly. We only have one main outlet, and that means that a drop of water stays in the lake on average for 191 years,
wow,
almost two centuries. So something that happened seven generations ago in our past is still with us, and that means that the Ojibwe or Anishinaabe ethic that we need to think seven generations in the future really applies to Lake Superior.
We're talking to Nancy Langston about her new book, Sustaining Lake Superior, An Extraordinary Lake in a Changing World. And Nancy, a lot has happened on the shores of Lake Superior over the last seven generations. You write about the impact, among other things, of deforestation along the shores of the lake and inland from there. Can you talk about what that did to Lake Superior?
Sure. When the loggers really logged much of New England, they moved to the Upper Great Lakes region, and here they found some extraordinary forests that were filled with white pine and hemlock, and they seemed so vast and abundant that nobody could ever cut them all down. You know, this was before chainsaws and big tractors, just two-man crosscut saws. But within 15 years, nearly all of the white pine and the really valuable timber on the south shores of Lake Superior were gone. And people stood up and looked around them and said, what have we done? And so the intense logging in around Lake Superior really motivated an American conservation movement. As the big companies moved out west to the Pacific Northwest, Gifford Pinchot and many other foresters in the region said, we need to think much more carefully about forest conservation because forests are crucial for protecting watersheds and water supplies and the future of our human communities as well.
And a big part of the spirit of your book isn't just listing the threats to Lake Superior past and present, though that's a big part of it, but also successful conservation efforts that have helped, at least some. When it came to that deforestation issue and the pollutants that allowed to flow into the lake, what kind of conservation efforts have made a difference since that time?
Yeah, absolutely. So many people look at Lake Superior right now, and we have almost 80% of the watershed as forested again. And we have wolves and moose and all sorts of extraordinary birds and some of the biggest lake trout in the world. And people think we have this incredible abundance because it's always been that way, because it's a pristine watershed. And I think a much more important story is that this was a lake at a tipping point a century ago, and communities came together. The tribes worked with states, worked with local grassroots groups, and they said, we don't want to collapse. We really want a sustainable future where there are jobs, but there's also clean water and healthy forests. And so I think a much more interesting story is that there's a grassroots effort in the past which has really helped sustain the kind of ecological diversity that we now celebrate here.
Another big story along Lake Superior is mining. You are in a place that was the center of copper mining in the United States for quite a while there. There have been iron mines, proposed new iron mines, among others. Can you talk about the impact that mining has had on Lake Superior in the past? And then we'll get into some current issues, too.
Sure. The biggest impact mining had on Lake Superior was bringing in big pressures for Americans to sign treaties with Native Americans. And so almost all of the treaties signed in the Upper Great Lakes region that now shape our social future were signed in order to make land available for mining. And that in turn enabled logging to really intensify, because once whites could get title to the land, then they move forward with big logging projects as well as mining projects. So now, a century and a half later, in some places we have much reduced water quality. Many of the streams and tributaries were actually filled in with tailings, with the waste from mines. We still have Superfund sites and areas of concern, places such as in right out my door right here, where there are PCBs and all sorts of toxics in what look like really clean waters. And much of that is from historic copper mining. So we have some real challenges, but we also have a changed social context where the Anishinaabe are still very much a part of the communities here, very much a part of our conservation futures. And they were as profoundly shaped by mining as anyone else in the basin.
And you spend a chapter on a more recent story about a proposed iron mine that ended up not happening, the Gogebic Taconite Mine in northern Wisconsin. Can you talk about that battle and how it fit into that history you were just talking about?
Sure. Lake Superior, by the mid-19th century, became the world's largest iron district. So most of the iron that was used to make steel, that helped build the Industrial Revolution in the lower Great Lakes, really came from Lake Superior. And most of that was very high-grade iron ore. It was called direct shipping ore because it could be dug up, stuck on a boat, and shipped down to the lower Great Lakes. When that iron ore was depleted during World War II, there was a huge amount of concern about what was going to sustain the economy here. And the state of Minnesota invested a lot in developing a low-grade iron ore called taconite. And taconite produces a massive amount of very finely ground waste that makes its way very easily into the water, into wild rice beds. It can smother the spawning grounds of the fish that sustain our communities. And yet it really helped rebuild the economy of Minnesota. So several years ago, in early 2011, a company called GTAC, Ogogebic Taconite, announced that they wanted to develop a huge low-grade iron ore deposit right at the border of Wisconsin and Michigan. And this had always been an iron mining area since whites came in. But it had been a mining area for really high-grade iron rather than this low-grade iron. And this proposed mine would have been the biggest open-pit mine in the world, and it would have been located just upstream of the Bad River Band wild rice beds and their reservation. And this created enormous concern among the tribes and among foresters and fisheries biologists and also local communities, because the contamination from that waste products of that mine could potentially have gotten into the wetlands, smothered and destroyed wild rice beds, and potentially destroyed the world's largest remaining wild rice beds. And so a coalition formed to try and force the state to really take the threats to tribal sovereignty and to water quality seriously, and above all, to pay attention to the effects on wild rice and on fisheries.
We're talking to Nancy Langston about her new book, Sustaining Lake Superior, An Extraordinary Lake in a Changing World. And you can join the conversation at 800-642-1234. Do you live near Lake Superior? Is the lake part of your life? What does it mean to you? What concerns do you have for the future of Lake Superior? And do you have questions for our guest? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our conversation now with Nancy Langston from Michigan Tech. Her new book is Sustaining Lake Superior, An Extraordinary Lake in a Changing World. You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your thoughts and questions. How important is Lake Superior in your life? Do you have concerns about pollution or thoughts about proposals for mines near the lake? Call 800-642-1234 or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Before we go to our callers, Nancy, I wanted to ask you about climate change and Lake Superior. How could climate change affect the lake?
Well, Lake Superior is the fastest warming large lake in the world. It's warming extraordinarily quickly. Ice cover has dropped almost 80% in recent decades, and that has huge effects on fisheries, for example, and also on the culture of ice fishing and on the amount of snow that falls. We've seen air temperatures increase by 1 degree Fahrenheit per decade. So what that means is if this continues, our summers could become like Oklahoma, up to 20 degrees Fahrenheit warmer during the summer. Our winters could become like Illinois, up to 12 degrees warmer. And some people might not think that's a really big deal. You know, we're a cold, northern, snowy place, and we'll stay fairly cold, at least in the winter. But it could have enormous changes on water temperatures. Our surface water temperatures are already increasing about 2 degrees Fahrenheit per decade. And again, that has big impacts on pollution, big impacts on fisheries, and also enormous impacts on our culture around Lake Superior.
Let's go to our callers now. We've got Steve on the line in Ashland. Steve, hi.
Hi. Could you, I'm driving, I'll probably fade out. Would you revisit the hog operation that's proposed for Bayfield and Ashland area? I've lost track of it.
Sure.
Was that something you've been tracking, Nancy?
I have not been tracking it as closely as I'm sure some of your listeners, but this would be an enormous hog operation that would have tens of thousands of animals, again, within the watershed of Lake Superior, within Fish Creek that then runs down into Lake Superior. And unlike a town of that size where we require that all the feces and be treated before it is allowed to run into the watershed, a confined animal feedlot operation like that does not require water treatment. And so there's the potential, a huge amount of concern, that this could really contaminate the world's largest lake by surface area. And so I share that concern, and I think it's essential that before we bring in such an enormous industrial agricultural operation into the watershed, that we really think seriously about what that means for water quality. And the simplest alteration would be, you know, to require treatment of that water supply before the contamination could make it into a Fish Creek and then into the lake. But the other big thing is you hear a lot of people say, well, farming is fine in the region. And the kind of small farms we've had are wonderful. But what I think people don't realize is that efforts to farm historically created a huge amount of erosion and sediment problems when farming was much more intensive than it is now. So our current farming that we now have in the basin is fairly sustainable. And I think it's really important to keep those farms continuing. But this enormous hog operation is something radically different. It's something much more similar to what's happened in Iowa and North Carolina, where they have had enormous, enormous problems with water contamination.
Thanks a lot for that call, Steve. Appreciate it. And you've written in your book about older agricultural problems related to pesticides affecting Lake Superior. Can you talk about that?
Sure. One really interesting case is the case of a chemical called toxaphene. And toxaphene was used largely in cotton agriculture, and we've never had cotton growing around Lake Superior. It's simply been too cold. But cotton that was grown in the American South, farmers put on a huge amount of this, you know, novel synthetic chemical called toxaphene to try and control all sorts of insect pests. And that chemical managed to get into the atmosphere and then make its way all the way into Lake Superior, where it was bioaccumulated, where it started in pretty low densities in the water, but then plankton ate it, and then little fish, and then big fish, until it finally got to such very, very high levels in our lake trout that it presented a real threat both to the fish and to the people who ate that fish. And so this is just one example where what we were doing here in the basin wasn't particularly bad, but we still became the source for pesticides that don't break down very quickly. And we see a lot of those still used throughout the world. And we really need to think about that those aren't just local problems, but they're also global problems.
And Nancy, as we wrap up, do you have a message for people concerned about the future of Lake Superior and how to sustain it?
We have some great examples from the past and even from the recent past, like the Great Lakes Compact, which makes sure that the entire Great Lakes Basin, which contains 22% of the world's fresh water. The compact was a situation where just over a decade ago, all the states and the provinces in Canada around the Great Lakes came together and said, we need strong institutions to protect our water. And so we created a compact that said water cannot be taken out of the basin. It can't be shipped to Asia. It can't be stuck in pipelines and sent to Phoenix to help them farm. That only under very, very restricted situations can people take water out of the basin to send somewhere else. And that is one of the most important and, I think, hopeful examples in the recent past of how we can learn from other regions, learn from our own history, and come up with a more sustainable future. So we face enormous changes in the Lake Superior Basin, but I think there's cause for a lot of hope because communities can come together and come up with solutions.
Nancy, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you so much.
That's Nancy Langston, professor of environmental history at Michigan Technological University. Her new book is Sustaining Lake Superior, an extraordinary lake in a changing world. Republican Governor Scott Walker confirmed yesterday what he'd hinted at all year. He is running for a third term next November. What remains unclear is who will be running against him. Several Democrats have launched campaigns for governor, but as Sean Johnson found out, they have some work to do to introduce themselves to voters.
Voters will go to the polls a year from today to pick Wisconsin's next governor. But in downtown Madison over the weekend, people willing to talk about the race still don't know much about the growing Democratic field. Most don't know how many candidates are running.
I know two for sure, probably three.
People struggle to name them all.
I'm familiar with Beinhout and one other one that doesn't come to my name right now.
And some names get mispronounced, like Tony Evers.
I think Tony Evers is going to be a good guy. I'm keeping an eye on him.
And Dana Walks.
The assemblyman is running from Western Wisconsin. Mokes or something like that?
It's Walks.
Walks, okay.
And another candidate, Matt Flynn, gets mistaken for someone else.
Yes. Familiar, but I don't know why.
It's because of the football player.
Oh, dang it.
She's talking about Matt Flynn, the former backup quarterback for the Green Bay Packers. That was Nancy Brace, Glenn Menzia, Carol Morley, Doug Kratch, and Kelly O'Connor. People who watch governor's races around the country for a living say Wisconsin's big Democratic field is not that unusual this election cycle. Jennifer Duffy is a senior editor with the Cook Political Report.
It looks a lot like fields I'm seeing in a number of states.
At least six Democrats have already announced they're running for governor in Wisconsin. State Superintendent Tony Evers, former state party chair Matt Flynn, businessman Andy Gronick, activist Mike McCabe, state senator Kathleen Vinehout, and state representative Dana Walks. The Cook Report's Duffy says Walker runs a very good campaign, but she says third terms are not easily come by, and the Democratic Party is fired up.
It's very unusual to see sort of the emotion and the intensity that always accompanies a presidential election to be still in full force a year out, a year away from that. And that's sort of where Democrats are right now.
Duffy says she'd be surprised if Wisconsin's Democratic field stays this big, but all signs now point to the field getting larger. Madison Mayor Paul Soglin says he's given a lot of thought to running for governor.
And I'm definitely leaning towards a candidacy for governor.
Soglin says an announcement could come in January. And former Madison State Representative Kelda Roy says she's also considering running.
Politically, there's still a lot of time.
But Roy says if a consensus choice for Democrats begins to emerge by early next year, she'd consider supporting them instead. Back on the streets of Madison, there are diverging views on what the big Democratic field means for the party's chances in 2018. Walker supporter Glenn Menzia of Sussex thinks it won't help them.
Some would call it enthusiasm. Others would call it just a bunch of people wanting to see if they can run for governor. And that's what I would call it.
Carol Morley of Neenah wants anybody but Walker. She's worried the Democratic field is too big and too unknown.
Well, since we're a year out, they should be well-known. So that makes me worry a little bit about the fact that maybe the Democratic Party is not out there educating voters.
But progressive voter Doug Kratch of Madison says he's not concerned about the size of the field.
I think it's okay. I think it means to me that there's a lot of people who think that Walker can be beat. I'd be more worried if there were no candidates.
If the candidates who are running now remain in the race, this will be Wisconsin's biggest primary for governor in decades. Sean Johnson, Wisconsin Public Radio.